We have, I think, three people signed up to testify. Jason, could you come over and briefly update us on Senate Bill 1034?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1034A modifies the definition of restricted energy electric activity for the purpose of electrical licensing exemption for licensed landscaper under electrical safety law. Restricted energy electrical activity to restrict class 2 and 3 installations and landscape low voltage lighting systems to 100 volt amperes and 300 volt amperes respectively. This bill was passed unanimously out of both the Senate Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs and the Senate.
Okay, thank you. Larry, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Larry Harvey. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. Our printed testimony is being delivered to you as I speak at this point. I'll give you a very brief synopsis in the interest of all the other folks here who I don't believe are here on behalf of Senate Bill 1034. We'll just briefly tell you that currently the statute allows landscape contractors to do a limited amount of low-voltage work. The statute, however, limits the ceiling to 100 volt amps currently. Much of the equipment that they would be using these days exceeds that. And so the recommendation in the bill that's before you is to change that, amend that statute to raise the ceiling to 300 volt amps. There's also in the bill was amended in the Senate to include that it must be also utilized in conjunction with a ground fault interrupter, circuit interrupter receptacle. These are not unusual pieces of equipment. The bottom line is that a lot of folks can simply go to the hardware store and or home base or something of that nature and buy the types of things that you can put into your flower beds and plug them in. So we're not really reinventing the wheel or going anything into nuclear power here. These are just simply adjustments in the statute to allow landscape contractors to continue to do what they've been doing for a number of years. Otherwise, they'll have to have guys like me go down to Home Depot and buy their stuff for them and put it in. So as a summary of the bill, that's the way it works. As you can tell, this bill has had a little, if no opposition. There was some suggestions from building codes. I see Mr. Brewer is here today, so he could answer any technical questions as to why he made some suggestions, but it's all worked out now between the landscape contractors, building codes, IBEW was helpful in doing this, as well as the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Any questions for Mr. Harvey?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I just am trying to make sure I understand. This may be a situation where I know enough to ask dangerous questions or stupid questions. What do you mean by cord connected to a ground fault interrupter receptacle? What does that mean? Is that like a power plug? You just stick it into the wall? Is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, that is very much my understanding of what the situation would be. It's not necessarily that you're wiring the pieces together, but in most cases they would come ready to assemble and you'd simply plug them in as you work your way along the sidewalk, if that's what you were lighting or in your backyard or something.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I have an understanding that there is currently available a particular license that's very easy to pick up around low-grade electricity or just a kind of entry-level licensing. Are you familiar with that? I forget the name of it exactly. Are you familiar with that licensing, that low-level licensing piece?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, I'm not familiar with that particular one. I'm only familiar with this. In this particular case, I've only familiarized myself with the statute that allows landscapers to do low-voltage work within certain context, which is already authorized.
Okay. One more question, if I might, Mr. Chair. In terms of you're basically putting things in, you're plugging them into each other, you're not doing any hard wiring. Are you doing any wiring in terms of timer cycles? I mean, if you got lights that are coming on or off, is there any wiring that you're getting into? If there's a motion detector so the lights come on, I mean, are you doing any of that kind of stuff? Or are these really self-contained components that are, you know, any idiot can put together, not that gardeners are idiots. No wish to imply that in any way, shape, or form in my testimony, I think, sir.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, there are a variety of products available at both the wholesale and retail level. We are, to answer your question very succinctly, we are talking about units that would plug into each other. However, there are variations among those products, and so it would not be unusual to have a system that would be triggered either by a photocell or by a motion detector or even a timer. And again, at the retail level, those very same products are all available now, so we're not really altering the products at all.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Harvey? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Craig Smith.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm a staff member of the Landscape Contractors Board. I'm here simply to represent the board's interest that this is a bill that they support and to answer any questions you may have.
Questions for Mr. Smith? Certainly not. Thank you.
Fine organization.
Representative Rasmussen, do you have something like that?
No, no, I was just really affirming my respect for the practitioners of the craft.
I join you in that.
Thank you,
Mr. Smith. Mr. Brewer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. As was indicated, the division's worked with the proponents on this bill to address some specific needs. In particular, the restricted energy license allows individuals to do work up to 100 volt amperes. It's typically control work. We worked with the proponents in this case to put some very specific restrictions around the work, allowing it to go up to 300 volt amperes. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Burr? Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Joe, are you concerned about the stranded costs that might be included in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that, requiring me to answer that question.
Any other questions for Mr. Burr? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else who would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 1034? I'll close the public hearing and opening the work session on Senate Bill 1034.
Mr.
Representative Decker.
I move Senate Bill 1034 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Decker moves Senate Bill 1034 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
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 I'm sorry, who? Excuse. Excuse. Aye. Senate Bill 1034 moves to the floor, and Representative King will carry the bill.
You can get out the door fast.
I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1034, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1149. Jason.
Mr. Chair, we have several sets of amendments before us, although I believe that we also have several that are not updated and haven't come before us yet. The ones that we do have are the committee amendments to -18, which I believe are up to date. The -14s, which are Representative Hills, the -23s, which are Representative Witt, the -16s, which are Pacific Corps. I believe that we're waiting on amendments for new amendments from BOMA, which would update their -15s, new coalition amendments, which would update their -13s, and new IBEW amendments. We also have conceptual amendments that would go along with the coalition. Are there any other amendments out there? I don't know about them at this time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rasmussen.
With all due respect, could you just run that through again? I started writing things down late.
Right now, we have the dash 18 committee amendment.
Okay, dash 18 committee amendment. Now, those are the amendments that deal with the aluminum company VSI.
Well, Mr. Chairman, dash 18 have already been amended before we got them, so which amendments are we talking about? The amended amendment or the amended amendment?
The amended amendment.
So we don't have the dash 18 amendments, we have the dash 18 amended amendments. Thank you.
My brain hurts.
We have Representative Hill's dash 14 amendment, Representative Witt's dash 23 amendment, Pacific Corps' dash 16 amendment. I believe that we're waiting on updated amendments from BOMA. Their old ones were the dash 15, and the Coalition, their old ones were the dash 13, and IBEW. We didn't have any prior ones submitted to the committee. If the committee likes, I'll proceed to, with the dash A18 committee amendment to describe it. The dash A18 committee amendment apply to section 3 public purposes. It states that an aluminum plant that averages over 100 megawatts of electricity per year shall pay a public purpose charge equal to 1% of the total revenue from the sale of electricity services from any source to the aluminum plant.
Chairman.
Representative.
Chairman, I would move the dash 18 amendments into Senate Bill 1149.
Representative Witt moves the dash 18 amendment. Discussion?
Chairman, there must be the dash 18 amendments as amended.
Yeah.
Dash 18 amendments as amendment. Amended. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Much, Chairman.
Is there any discussion?
One more.
Call the roll, please.
Yes.
Excuse.
Montgomery?
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. The dash 18 amendments as submitted are adopted. Yeah.
I'm not asking, but
it's definitely great on especially anything new that we haven't heard before. It'd be wonderful.
Yeah.
The next set of amendments are the dash A14 amendments submitted by Representative Hill. These apply also to Section 3. They reduce the portion of 3% public purposes funds to be allocated for new cost-effective conservation and market transformation from 68% to 63%. Of the 3% public purpose funds, 5% shall be allocated to the Housing and Community Services Department revolving account. It also replaces language regarding low-income bill payment assistance. It states that the amount to be collected for low-income bill payment assistance shall be $10 million. Directs the PUC to determine each electric company's proportionate share of that $10 million and also to determine the amount to be collected from a retail electricity consumer. These amendments also state that a retail electricity consumer shall not be required to pay more than $500 per month and continuously appropriates monies deposited in the revolving account. It also states that priority assistance to low-income electricity consumers who are in danger of having their electricity services cut off.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Chairman, I would move the dash 14 amendments into Senate Bill 1149.
Representative Witt moves the dash 14 amendments into Senate Bill 1149.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
I don't mean to be a problem, Chairman, but I don't seem to have a set of dash 14s in front of me.
Thank you, Representative. I don't either, but I thought
no. I'm not sure they've been distributed. I'm pretty good about making sure stuff gets into my file folder.
Apologize.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was there once.
Well, actually, I think, are you, is this the complete set here, Jason?
Is there anyone who would like to testify on the dashboard? Going. Gone. Take a moment for members to look at the dashboard team.
That would be nice. Thank you.
So we don't need the dash 13?
We're not there yet.
Rosenbaum.
14 before.
Mr. Chair, is there any opposition? It does not appear to be any opposition at this point in time.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I wanted a little more information about I guess this would be on line 9 of the amendments. It talks about using this 5% resource of providing grants described in ORS 4586252A-3. Could you tell us what those purposes are?
That is the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, purpose of the trust fund. So
is it? Follow-up question. Is this related to the original purpose for which this money was put in the bill, but designated for low-income housing, or is it just
low-income housing? The statute covers the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. So the monies would be able to be expended for those purposes. Is that line in that statute?
So it's not specifically for low-income energy assistance or conservation? Or
energy assistance is in a different portion of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Decker.
Thank you. Just for the record, the money, if you or someone walks through how the money might flow in terms of the 5% of the 3% and where it would flow from and how it would be distributed.
Is the gentleman here from Housing and Community Services come up and explain how the program works?
For the record, my name is Alan Kramer, Representative Hill, committee. In terms of the trust fund, how the monies are appropriated and so forth, the trust fund is the only source of revenue we have that pays for pre-development costs for affordable housing, low-income housing, as it's sometimes called. The corpus, what we use is the interest off the corpus for those pre-development costs. If there are any further questions, if I can answer them, I'd be glad to. I'm more on the energy side of the low-income spectrum, but I can answer some questions about affordable housing.
Representative Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't get the name.
Alan Kramer.
Mr. Kramer, thank you. If you'd be willing just to just walk through how the money would move in terms of from the fund, the 3% of the 5%, and how it would be distributed, and maybe just an example of how that would occur.
The monies are placed into a fund, a corpus. The interest from that corpus would then be applied for by affordable housing builders along with other trust fund monies currently in that corpus, the interest of that corpus. Specifically for affordable housing, which includes long-term energy efficient types of building procedures so that it remains affordable for a long period of time. They have to meet current codes and those sorts of things, and energy efficient appliances may be part of that and that sort of stuff.
Thank you.
Is Peter Grenfossen here? Can I come up?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Peter Grenfossen. I represent the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities, and I'm here to speak favorably on the Dash 14 amendments to SB 1149. Some of you have heard me speak in other committees as to the housing crisis that Oregon is facing. We have 107,000 households in this state that earn less than 50% of median income and pay more than 30% of that income for rent and utilities. And it's these households are all at risk of homelessness because their incomes are so scant. This is the bottom 25% of the economy. And so the situation is desperate for them. In addition to that, we have another 6,000 people that are homeless in Oregon every night, including 2,000 children. The basic problem for many of these people is just the absence of affordable housing. And the amendment which Representative Hill has provided here as a possibility for this bill provides an opportunity for some funding for some of the necessary housing. All of you are aware of the restraints on the state budget at this time. We're in a desperate situation. We've got far more programs that need funding in this state than we're going to be able to find money for. And this amendment could provide an opportunity to provide some of the necessary housing that we face in the next biennium.
Thank you.
That.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, maybe you can answer for me, what is the nexus between the dollars collected from power use on an overall basis and a provision for grants for affordable housing?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, every one of these houses will be, or housing units will be built to code, and code includes the necessity of proper weatherization and energy savings facilities and so forth. And to that extent, this money can be interrelated with other housing money that is available. That may become available, and together they can make a package. So that there's a direct connection here. I see a direct connection here.
Okay. Follow up,
Representative Crummell.
Thank you. Will these grants then go directly to the builders, or will they go to local governments, or how will that be put together?
There are housing, what we call housing providers in the state. It includes private contractors and nonprofit organizations and the state's 22 housing authorities. I happen to represent the housing authorities, but there are a number of housing providers out there, and they go to the State Department of Housing and Community Services, and they present plans, proposals for buildings, for apartment houses and single family dwellings, and they compete with one another. And as money becomes available, why, then it's made available for the best projects. It's highly competitive.
Representative Crummell.
Will the dollars then, because I see in the Dash 14s that it's an amount that's going to be equal to $10 million. Are those dollars intended then to be leveraged? Or is it just the interest off of the $10 million that's going to create the grain?
Representative Crummell, I can jump in and answer that question. In terms of the $10 million figure, in the way the bill is printed today, there is no upper cap on low income energy assistance. The amendments place a cap at $10 million. In terms of that part of the amendment has nothing to do with the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. That has to do with low-income energy assistance programs.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that puts a cap in terms of the dollars amount to be collected.
Okay. So then, Mr. Chair, if I may, back up to the dollars for the housing revolving, then will those dollars be, is it intended that those dollars, that's the 5%, correct? Those dollars will be leveraged, or will they, or at that point?
They are heavily leveraged, Mr. Chairman and Representative Crummell, committee. The money that flows through Housing and Community Services from various sources is highly leveraged against available federal dollars, available local dollars, local that might be available, say, from the local jurisdictions, and that's not doesn't amount to much, but there's some there. And it's leveraged against private mortgages. So that leverage has been running. The Housing Trust Fund has been leveraging out at around 15 or 20 to 1. It is very well leveraged. You get a better bang for your buck out of Housing Trust Fund money than any other depository in the state.
Thank you. You want to let us know how you really feel?
Sure. Are there any further questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on or about the Dash 14? Hearing and seeing none. Annetta, would you please call the roll?
Yes.
King.
Aye.
Rommel.
Aye.
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 Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Hughes.
Aye.
Aye. Dash 14s are adopted into the bill. We just got from Legislative Council the consensus amendments, which are being photocopied right now. We'll distribute those, and we may take a recess to let people, those are lengthy, and have time for people to look at those, discuss those. But we're going to continue on right now with the other amendments we do have right now. And I just wanted to let you know that those will be coming.
The next set of amendments that we have, Mr. Chair, are Representative Witt's A-23 amendments. And that is, I'd like to defer to Representative Witt on this.
Are they part of the back in here? Oh, sorry.
They're in the back. I have them.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Dash 23 amendments provide $5 million per year beginning on January 1, 2000 to be collected by electric companies to use for low-income energy assistance. If you remember in the bill, this program providing dollars for low-income energy assistance in Senate Bill 1149 does not begin until October 1, 2001, which is the day the direct access commences. That means we would have a period of approximately 2 years prior to when the low-income energy assistance would become available to help qualified, needy, low-income Oregonians to help pay their electric bills during the winters. So what I did is I brought this bill forward, setting that at $5 million to provide this much-needed assistance, and this would start January 1, 2000. And it would be up to $5 million. Then when direct access begins, it would be up to a maximum of $10 million.
Representative Montgomery?
Thank you. I guess the question is, somebody, they had a coalition going over in the Senate, and they got together and came up with some ideas. Were these addressed during the coalition as part of the whole thing, or did this just something popped up all at once? And then why this, Dave, just so we can build up some more money?
Now, actually, to answer your two questions, Representative, first of all, I know this issue was discussed in the Senate because I attended a couple work sessions in the Senate where these ideas were put forth. We decided at that point in time not to make a final decision relative to low-income energy assistance prior to the date direct access begins. But this is not a case of building up the money. This money will be used. This money will go into the appropriate fund deposited in the Housing and Community Services Department revolving account, and it will be available beginning January 1, 2000 to be used with other dollars which come from the federal government to assist low-income Oregonians in terms of paying their heating bills.
If I like a follow-up.
Representative Montgomery.
Then at the Senate side, it was decided this shouldn't be included, and now we're looking at to include it, I guess, is the question I have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Montgomery, I don't think that's really an accurate statement. I think what Senate side was decided to punt on this issue, and in fact, I let Senator Durfler know at that point in time when this was being considered that I would be pleased to deal with this issue and try to deal with it in the House. And it was at a point in time when they were trying to move the bill out of the Senate. So I think Senator Durfler knew that this issue was still outstanding. Certainly the people who were proponents of this knew it was outstanding, and I had a conversation with them and told them I would bring this in front of the House committee to give them an opportunity to make their argument in front of our committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make a better argument.
Representative Witt.
Sorry, my argument wasn't good enough, Representative.
There are people. Was there discussion of this in front of the committee, or was this just all the work?
Oh, this was discussed in front of the committee in the Senate, yes. In fact, I was there one day when this whole issue was being discussed. And there's some people here today who could enlighten us on that even further.
Okay. Representative Kimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this going to have the effect, basically, of increasing the fees or increasing the rates that residential ratepayers are going to pay?
Can I answer that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Yeah, Representative, if you look at the bill, when the date direct access starts, which is October 1, 2001,
sure.
The electric utilities then have to start collecting a fee for low-income energy assistance that will be up to a maximum of $10 million based upon Chair Hill's amendment that we just adopted. That, October 1, 2001, implies, yes, that residential customers and commercial customers are going to be paying dollars into the fund that will be used for low-income energy assistance. But what this amendment does is it cuts it back to $5 million for that first two-year interim period, but it collects it in essence through the same mechanism.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rasmussen?
I might break in. It appears that the copies of the coalition's amendment has been cleaned out. Is it our policy?
We're going to get more copies.
We are going to bring in more copies?
Yes.
Great.
Sorry, if I can follow, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell, that doesn't change. All we're doing here is we're moving this forward. We're moving this to January 1, 2000, up to a maximum of $5 million to help with this problem in terms of low-income energy assistance. And then when direct access begins, as provided for in the bill, which is October 1, 2001, that figure goes to a maximum of $10 million. All we're doing here is we're setting up, we're providing some temporary assistance over that two-year period at a smaller dollar number.
Ramping up.
Right.
To where we will be.
And if I can, Mr. Chair, I've had the experience of being out in Washington County the day that these funds are distributed. And I can tell you what has happened is that traditionally the federal government was providing dollars out to the states, which are administered through various mechanisms in the state. And Washington County is administered through Washington County Community Action Organization. This is one of the things they do to help low-income folks who qualify to get some assistance in terms of paying their heating bills. The federal contributions to this program has declined drastically over the last 10 or 15 years. And today, we are not able to serve anywhere near the number of people that qualify for assistance in paying their heating bills over the winter. These are very low-income people. What we are doing here is we're providing some mechanism of providing some additional dollars to be used with those federal dollars to try to reach out and provide assistance to more qualifying people.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Representative. Why is it that the charge in this amendment is only being levied on residential customers when the original bill spreads it among all customers?
I'm going to have someone come up and address that, Representative.
Okay. Commissioner Ickes, you want to talk about this issue in terms of the...
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple of questions to kind of clarify.
Tom, you want to come up as well?
It's okay. I asked a couple of the service providers to come up with me so they can talk about the urgency of it.
Commissioner Ickes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually just had a couple of clarifying questions, one of which has actually already been asked by Representative Rosenbaum. the amendment talks about collecting an electric company collecting, which is the IOUs. The amendment also says the statewide total amount collected shall equal $5 million, but we determine each electric company's proportionate share. And I'm not clear whether the $5 million is statewide amount for electric companies or statewide amount for everybody, and the proportionate share is based on whether or not the proportionate share is based on an assumption that the statewide total is comes from only electric companies, or whether it would be the proportionate share assuming other non IOUs. In other words, is this $5 million 100% IOUs, or is the proportionate share of IOUs based on 75% of it, 75% of $5 million coming from the IOUs, because that's their approximate proportionate share?
Chairman, I think Mr. Schwab might be able to give us some clarification on that. I'm pretty sure I know the answer, but I think I'd like to hear from him.
For the record, since we're discussing charity, I'll get down on my knees. For the record, my name is Tom Schwab. I'm coordinator of the Western Energy Partnership. We reached an agreement with the public utilities to be the best way to operate what they provide.
Thank you.
What they provide for energy assistance. So the context of both the $10 million in Chair Hill's amendment and this $5 million is it relates only to the IOUs. And we feel encouraged, and in talking with the public utilities, they can voluntarily come up with programs that they feel comfortable with. So these numbers would apply only to the IOUs.
So, Mr. Chair. So I think Commissioner Meek has answered your question, and it's $5 million from the IOUs.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My other question was, in
I'm a little bit on there today, and I'll probably be slower. In essence, what this is, it's just a tax on your electric bill. Is that in essence what it is?
Are you asking me, Representative?
Yeah, I'm going to be on your electric bill. I want everybody to know that. Good morning. Thank you.
I'm just trying to ask questions. My other question, Mr. Chairman, I think was just asked by Representative Rosenbaum. The existing bill, when the $10 million goes, or when the bill assistance, which under your previous amendment, I guess now would be $10 million, goes into effect, it says that the commission determined amounts to be collected from retail electric consumers with a 500 per month cap per site. This, however, is collected only from residential retail electric consumers, and I'm wondering whether that's, since there's a difference between these, whether that was the intent or whether it was the intent is to be consistent with the bill that would apply after direct access.
Mr. Chairman,
maybe
we can ask Mr. Schrod it.
Well, if it's okay with Commissioner Reeder, I'd like to just take a couple minutes to advise and propose this amendment. And you talked about the urgency of it, and in doing that, I think we can answer your question. Bobby McGill from the Salvation Army and Joan Cody from the Oregon Energy Coordinators Association will talk about the urgency in terms of the need for additional funding.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, I will. My name is Joan Cody. I am the Energy Program Director for Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency here in Salem, and I also chair the Oregon Energy Coordinators Association, which is a statewide organization made up of energy assistance coordinators and weather station coordinators. In 1985, Oregon spent approximately $17.7 million to help 87,994 Oregonians pay their energy bill. Last year, due to cuts in the federal funding that had come down since 1985, federal low-income energy assistance funds assisted approximately 40,000 Oregonians with about $8 million. The amount of money that we received for the 1998-99 heating season was gone in 4 months. That's at the agency here in Salem. We still get calls daily for people who are in danger of having their power shut off. While the bill, as it stands, will raise more money in 2001, the need still exists today and in 2000.
And Bobby McGill represents the Salvation Army, which is the agency that people go to when they no longer come to the agency to get federal money, and she can describe their experience.
For the record, I'm Bobby McGill. I'm the Metro Family Services Director of Salvation Army in Portland, Oregon. And the Salvation Army, I went back 10 years, and we have served 100,000 plus individuals with over $4 million in private monies. The CAP agencies use federal dollars. They run out. We fund, we assist the families after they run out. Usually they start enough ahead in their season that they're out of money by the time we start. Finding people that need this money is not a problem. We turn them away daily. Having enough money to help the people is what we need. The money's coming in 2001 will take care of most of the need in Oregon, but there are going to be people that are cold the winter of 2000-2001 unless we have the bridge and have money to help them.
Yes, Representative Montgomery.
Thank you. A question to whoever. Mm-hmm. This is a tax on electrical bills. What if they have natural gas? Does it go to people pay their bills also, or is it just a piece of that electricity?
Mr. Chair and Representative Montgomery, this would be specifically targeted to electric customers, and partly that's at the request of the electric utilities. We thought it was fair. What they requested is that if electric ratepayers are paying this charge, it ought to go back to ratepayers of the same utility. The federal program, especially with this additional funding, we believe the federal program would be sufficient to allow us to help natural gas, wood, oil, and other users. In Oregon, the vast majority, I believe 60-70% of low-income people who qualify for this program use electric as their primary heating source.
Representative Kremel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schraw, I remember at one time when we met and we talked about an unmet need, and it was, if I'm not mistaken, at least in one of my counties, it was estimated that the unmet need was, some astronomical number, 52% or something like that. The funds that are going to be provided for in this, how much of, as we look at it on a statewide basis, how much of the unmet need is this going to accomplish? Let me distinguish between two separate things, and then this, I think, will finally address Commissioner Ickes's question. The figure that is in the bill effective 2001, October 2001, $10 million, that was our original goal, and the idea there was to be able to get back to where we were in 1985. In 1985, we helped about 80,000 Oregonians. That would allow us to get back to that level. The $5 million is targeted even more specifically to people who we can't help, who are experiencing shutoff, payment difficulties, et cetera. Whatever word you want to use to describe it, this money will actually help ratepayers save money because all the analysis we've done shows that as LEAP funding has gone down, the costs associated with collection and the costs associated with debt for both Pacific and PGE have gone up. So we know that there's a relationship between energy assistance funding and utilities losing money on debt, which the ratepayers end up paying. So we believe that this $5 million, a big chunk of that, and I don't think it's possible to guess how much, will actually be reflected in corresponding reductions in uncollectible debt for people who can't pay their bill.
Mr. Chair.
Now, with that background, if you would answer my question, which was how much of the unmet need will be met by this? I mean, if it takes care of 80,000 Oregonians, is that how many people we have? I mean, is that 100% of the need, or is there, 328,000 people that have need? And so now, what we're going to be helping is 80,000. Which gets us back to 1985 levels, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if it's, but if we have 328,000 people that have a need, then obviously we've only hit about 25% of the need. How much is this going to?
Yeah.
Is this going to? Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, in 1985, the funding that we got, the $18 million, ended up being sufficient funding to help about 50% of the people who are eligible for the program.
currently about 20% of people who are eligible are able to get funding. So the result of that is we get long waiting lists. And as Representative Witt mentioned, opening day of this program in Washington County, there was a long line of people waiting at 7 in the morning. With the additional $10 million in funding, we estimate it would help about 40% of people who are eligible for the program. How does that address unmet need? I don't think we'll know completely until we implement the program, because what we don't want to do is encourage people who don't need it to use it. It's not an entitlement program. It's not something that you automatically get. We want it to be a resource that is available for people who need it. But on the other hand, for people who don't need it, we wouldn't want to encourage them to apply.
Representative King and then Representative Rosenberg.
Thank you. We had started off with Ms. Rikas addressing one question, had some questions, and we've got one of those questions I think answered by another person. I didn't know if he had a chance to contribute the question, so I wanted to check back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative King, I may have missed it, but I'm still unclear as to why.
Yeah, if I can, just a second, Representative Rosenbaum, we'll come back.
I was just going to reiterate.
Is that right? That's your point, which you started with. I think that under the bill itself, Senate Bill 1149, it does not make that distinction between residential and customers, which would include non-residential customers. Based upon that, it seems to me, Mr. Schraw, unless you feel otherwise, it seems to me that we might want to strike the word residential conceptually from the Dash 23 amendments. Is that, do you have any objection to that?
No.
Does anybody want to give any comment on that at that point?
I'm a no. I have an objection to it, but I have an objection to the whole thing, so I guess it doesn't really matter. A tax is a tax, not a holy cow. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, the statement that was made, and I tried to paraphrase it here, a rate increase will save the user's money. That's an interesting prospect, and I think that's what we should maybe make it double than the saving twice as much. Not a logical statement, I don't think.
Yeah, I think, if I can, Mr. Chair, you're cheering again there. Representative Montgomery, I think what Mr. Schraw is leading to that is that people who cannot pay their heating bill in the winter end up defaulting in many cases. And by giving them this assistance during the winter, it helps minimize defaults for non-payment. And to that extent, it becomes, this assistance we're giving helps the utility avoid losses on bad debt or with customers who default because they're not able to afford their bill. I think that's the point that was being made.
Yes, Mr. Chair, one particular utility, Clark County PUD, actually has done an analysis of a program they've operated for 10 years, and what they found out is that when they gave people a minimal amount of energy assistance to make the payment level something they could afford, it actually reduced their uncollectibles and their debt collection expenses to the extent that it was cheaper to do it that way than it was to incur the cost.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for everything. I understood what you're trying to get at. In my district, I have a lot of underemployed people who are still paying their bills, and now they're going to be paying these other people's bills, and they just barely afford to pay their own bills. So I think we should help them, too. I mean, we've got to draw a line someplace, and this is not the line I'm happy with at all, obviously.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative.
I don't think I've done this. I would move the Dash 23 amendments in the Senate Bill 1149.
Do you want to make your
amendment
first?
Yeah, I do want to make a conceptual amendment, though, first to delete on line 4 the word residential.
Representative Witt moves to conceptually amend the dash 23 amendments for Senate Bill 1149
Mr.
on line 4 and strike the word residential.
Mr.
Chairman, conceptual amendments, are they allowed at this late stage of the game? Are we taking conceptual amendments or are they going to be in print?
We have other taken the practice of this committee has always been to accept conceptual amendments, but this is a single strike word. I don't even think technically if we strike the word residential, it's a conceptual amendment because they can be, you can have a single word struck. But in terms of, are you comfortable, Representative Montgomery, with the conceptual amendment?
No. I'm going to vote no, so go ahead. I'm the only one up here, so it doesn't matter. I'm outnumbered, but I'm still
going to
vote no.
Do you object to the conceptual amendment? They didn't ask the right question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen?
You will be needing a suspension of the rules, I believe.
Okay.
I move a suspension of the rules.
Representative King moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of amending the dash 23 amendments. Please call the roll.
President Decker?
Yes.
Aye.
Trumbull?
Aye.
Montgomery?
No.
Rasmussen?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Zimmerman? Witt?
Aye.
Churchill?
Aye. The rules are suspended for the purposes of conceptually amending dash 23 amendments. Representative Witt, your motion will now be in order.
Okay, my two. Conceptually yes. Amend. Mr. Chairman, I would move that we amend conceptually the dash 23 amendments to Senate Bill 1149 to delete the word residential from line 4 of the amendment.
Representative Witt moves to conceptually amend the dash 23 amendments by striking the word residential on line 4 of the amendments. Discussion? Chairman. Representative Montgomery.
Just a comment, I guess. So now in addition to the tax from the residential people, we're going to impose a tax from the business people, too. I just want to get that.
That is correct, Representative.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I would point out to the committee that what we're doing here is no different than what we're doing in the bill. We're just doing it earlier to provide some of this assistance at a lower level earlier. We're not doing anything for these amendments that we're not doing in the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just point out I'm going to go ahead and support this, but I'm not comfortable with where we're at on the unmet need. That was something that was really hammered home to me last fall, and I'm quite concerned about that. And with all due respects, 50% of the need being met in 1985 and 50% of the need in 1999. There's a big difference. The population has grown in this state by some 20% in the last in the last 15 years. Well, we've gone from about 2.7 million people to about 3.4 million people in that 15-year period. That's a fairly substantial increase in the population. How much of that population growth has risen? Made the unmet need go up. So I'm concerned about that. Does this really get us where? I guess my question is it enough?
Thank you. Any further discussion?
The answer is no, it's not enough. However.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. No further discussion.
Sometimes I hear politics is the art of
the question before us now is possible. The conceptual amendment to dash 23. Would you please call the roll?
President Decker?
Aye.
King?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
Montgomery?
No.
Rasmussen?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chairman?
Witt?
Aye.
Churchill?
Aye. The dash 23s are conceptually amended. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the dash 23 amendments as conceptually amended into Senate Bill 1149.
Representative Witt moves the Dash 23 amendments as conceptually amended into Senate Bill 1149. Discussion.
Chairman,
Representative Montgomery. Representative Montgomery.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we're turning this into a tax to spend bill. In the beginning when it came here, there was a lot of happy people with it. Now we have 22 Dash 22 amendments, and this one here, 23 amendments, and it's more of this tax spend stuff, and we've got to slow down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. End of my speech.
Thank you, Representative Montgomery. Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone else who has not testified on the Dash 23 amendments and who would like to? I assume from the absence of anyone else that everyone is in favor of them.
Thank you. Except for.
Except for. Sorry, one exception on the committee. He can speak for himself. Please call the roll.
Decker? Aye.
Shane?
Aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
Montgomery?
Aye.
Oh! Got you into that? Yes, no.
Get that gavel down.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Dash 23 amendments are adopted into Senate Bill 1149. Boma, you guys have new amendments coming?
Chairman Hill, Ann Fisher for Boma. Boma has sponsored Dash 15 amendments. At this stage, we don't have any new language to proffer, and so I'm disinclined to take them off the table, although I could conceptually amend them, since now I've learned this new process, to delete the energy efficiency self-direction aspect. But it may be better to postpone consideration until we have better language before you.
Representative Montgomery, if I may, I have the Dash 15, so what is wrong with them, Mr. Chairman, that we need to take out? And I would be pleased to conceptually amend anything right now.
It is my understanding that there is concern over, first, the self-direction on energy efficiency, and BOMA is willing to withdraw that portion of the amendment on the basis that the primary interest of BOMA is to find a way to deal with what happens after commercial customers are put out into the market. At this stage, there is some debate. I think that certainly people have told me that they support the language as is, but there are other people, I think, that would like to have additional dialogue.
Are they being drafted? Has anyone requested?
To answer your question, Chairman Hill, there is nothing in the works in the sense of sending it to Legislative Council. I think that the intent is perhaps to have further discussions with the PUC and then present something to Legislative Council. Although I think the certainly BOMA's clear direction is to keep the spirit of the amendment that's currently sitting there.
Commissioner Ekus and Tom Gallagher, are you? Tom here? Do we have an understanding on this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not sure we do, and I think that it's because of maybe some confusion as to exactly which situation is trying to be addressed. If I could, let me give you a conceptual view of what I think may be the issue that we're trying to work through in terms of identifying what the real issue is. There is contemplated in both what we did in the PGE UE 102 restructuring order and in what Senate Bill 1149, how it is written, the concept of what we call a cost of service rate. and that is a rate based upon existing resources, existing cost of service. It would be similar to what existing, similar basis for determining the existing rate. That cost of service rate is made available to certain customers. In this bill, it's made available to the residential customers, and the PUC is given the ability to make it available to other customers if we believe it's necessary to do so. In the UE 102 proceeding, the PUC decided we would make cost of service available to all customers. However, in the UE 102 proceeding, we said, if you're non-residential and you choose direct access, you do not get to come back the cost of service. There is, however, another concept that is called the default rate, and that is different than cost of service. And it is something which we contemplate. The default responsibility may be bid out if the utility does not want to do it. The default responsibility is not based on the cost of service basis. And the default rate's purpose is for a customer for whom the competitive market has failed in a sense. Either your energy service provider all of a sudden went out of business, or you don't have anyone to serve. All of a sudden, for some reason, you don't have anyone serving you. You go to the default rate. The default rate is more than likely to reflect short-term market costs of going out immediately into the market and acquiring the additional power to serve that customer that now seeks the default rate. What we have tried to avoid is the situation in which, in determining the cost of service rate, customers can keep going back and forth, because that is very difficult for any utility, any cost of service provider, to try and determine how much resources, how much cost to incur to serve a load that's going to fluctuate that frequently. So we have always contemplated, if we did establish a cost of service rate for customers who had direct access, there would either be some, there'd be some limit on their ability to come back. And that limit in 102 was, once you left, you didn't come back. You were out in the market, or you end up going to the default rate. In 1149, we established a cost of service rate for residential customers, and I believe it's Section 4 provides that we can decide to make a cost of service rate available to other customers, and in Section 15, or on page 12, it provides for, we provide for what we call the default service. What's been unclear in the BOMA amendments and in the discussion is whether or not what BOMA is really looking for is the ability to go to a default rate, or whether what they're really after is what we call the cost of service rate. If what they are after is the cost of service rate, it means that I think you are left with some decisions of changing the basic direction that was established in 1149 or 102, which did not establish a requirement, or 1149 does not establish a requirement for cost of service rate for all customers or for commercial customers. And I think that's an issue. If, in fact, that's what they are asking for, to go back and forth to the cost of service rate, then you need to decide whether or not you want to have a require a cost of service rate, and whether or not we will still have the ability, which their amendments do seem to recognize, that we could put some limitations on how and when you could do that. The concerns are that it has the potential of raising the cost of service rate for customers, and that it may have some inhibiting effect on the market and an energy service provider's desire to start serving those customers if they know that the customers can just leave, go and out of the market, back to cost of service, out of the market, back to cost of service. But so if the issue, we're trying to clarify whether the issue is really default service or whether it's cost of service issue.
So, but under the present bill, they could come out of market to a default rate, which for the purposes of the consumer who is in the market, and they're buying power at market, and they decide they don't like that for some reason, is there greater stability in the price in the default category? So that, and am I correct? That's what you're ultimately looking for, is for somebody who says, I don't want to go do this for some whatever reason. They're looking for something where it's a stable pricing scheme, or is it you want to go to cost of service?
Mr. Chairman, the default rate may not be, I'm not sure what you mean by stable, but it may not be a stable rate. It's more likely to reflect immediate short-term market costs of acquiring it. It may be that if you put it out for a competitive bid, the bidder would do an estimate of what over a period of time the market's likely to look like, and they might actually bid a firm rate for the default rate. But it's more likely to reflect the market than the cost of service rate, which is going to reflect cost of service.
Let me ask the question this way before I answer it. If are we creating a potential where a landowner, building owner, goes and makes a choice to get out of cost of service? Are we risking a decision that ultimately may be a deterrent to someone in the ability for them to sell this property because, in terms of what the market does, you know, I mean, is there going to be? I guess the question is, how big of a disparaging difference are you going to envision between cost of service and market, in terms of, so that, because it is potential that instead of saving money, you risk it could go up because of the way you under the rate proceedings, you have a stable rate and they may not be able to raise it up, but market rates may go above cost of service. That is a risk. And if it goes too askew, I guess you would adjust the rates anyway in the cost of service.
Mr. Chairman, I think what's envisioned here is that you've got a competitive market, and that the enterprise that has direct access would have multiple providers to choose from, and that. The whole concept here is that to some extent the market takes care of that. The cost of service is designed really to provide a basis for those that, particularly as residential customers, are least likely to have a market. The bill made a decision that it left it up to the PUC to decide that if we felt that there was some risk that that customers were not going to have access to a competitive market, maybe in the early stages we weren't sure how quickly a market would develop. It does give us the ability to provide a cost of service. The issue is whether or not it's going to be required, and how often can someone go back and forth, and I think that there is risk in the market. There will be times when the market is higher than cost of service. It may also be that it's lower. It will also depend on the utility. In PGE's case, they're already out of the market, so I'm not sure what the difference will be. But I think maybe Mr. Gallagher can address some thoughts on what the market
might. Let's jump over to Ann first.
In listening to Commissioner Ekus, it occurs to me that perhaps we need to redefine our terms, because what appears to be the stumbling block are the words cost of service versus market, for want of a better word. I think what BOMA is envisioning is how to address what happens if the market is not as vibrant as those people who believe in dereg think it will be. We have in this bill fail-safes for the residential class, and you know that some of the commercial customers are no bigger or no more easily aggregated than those residential customers. Our concern is that if the market doesn't work well, or people don't want the added cost of being in the market and dealing with providers, kind of like answering the phone for the telephone solicitors, that they can come back to something, and maybe you want to call that a regulated rate. the way I read this bill, and part of our concern is that it can be read in several different ways, is that the commission can make these decisions but it's not required to. And what BOMA is seeking is the assurance that there will be something out there that is more than just an emergency situation, which is what I think Commissioner Ickes was describing, the default rate, but a regulated rate that commercial and presumably industrial customers can come back to if they just don't like living in the market that we sent them to because we thought it was going to work. It is that scenario, whether it's done out of emergency reasons or because it makes economic sense for customers, that we're trying to get to. I think the amendments with the conceptual modification on the energy self-direction, energy efficiency self-directions, would do that, because what it says is the commission shall develop this other bucket, and the commission will do rulemaking to figure out how to address the issues that Commissioner Ickes raises, whether or not, in fact, there will be an effect on the price, or whether it will, in fact, lead the market, or whether the default provider does it through the market or does it in some other arrangements. I wonder if we call the cost of service rate, if that's not the stumbling block, and if we change the word from cost of service, that the customer, commercial customers or industrial customers could go to a regulated rate and keep the rulemaking in it, if we don't, in fact, address the concerns that have been articulated.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher representing PG&E Energy Services. Section 4, as I've constantly argued, makes perfect sense the way it's written. And the situation that BOMA raises hasn't taken place in any other state of the 20-some states that are in the process of deregulation. I checked with our people that are selling as energy service providers to large buildings in California, and I'm not going to go through that list of states. They don't have the problem that she defines. What an energy service provider and the bill does is it sets up a market for those people who are large enough and smart enough to do their buying on their own, those people who aren't residential customers. The market is already established all over the country for these kinds of people. They will go to an energy service provider, and by contract, they will decide the terms and the amount of risk that they want to take on in the purchase of their energy and for what length of time. They can do it as an individual company, as a building. They can do it through a larger aggregation or umbrella organization. The BOMA of San Francisco operates that way. They bring their customers together and have a contract with an energy service provider. What Section 4 allows is for all of the different parties to go back to the PUC and work through in some detail a situation that would allow people either to go back to a cost of service or to set up a default rate. As a matter of fact, Section 4 in Sentence 2 talks about a cost of service rate for these folks. What we who are working about developing the market do not want to happen is a subsidized cost of service rate that is by definition in terms of subsidy below the market, because then the market will not develop. You can't have it both ways. You either have to deregulate for these folks and create a market and encourage the market to develop. And what Section 4 will let them do through the PUC is decide if there are any anomalies, short term or whatever, that can be set by rule to take care of this. What we talked about in your office, Representative Witt, was the concept of a default rate for people who wanted to flop back and forth out of the market. That is the most expensive kind of default rate that they could get. And it doesn't, I said then and I say now, it doesn't make any sense to me. But that sounds like what they wanted. And the PUC, when we went to write it, went, didn't make any sense to them either.
And
I want to focus on what we're trying to do, or what Bowman is trying to do. PG&E is a good player in the market. Don't have any doubt that some customers will see some really good deals by dealing with them. There are other big players in the market, and certainly if I had a load of 10, 20, or 30 or more megawatts, I would have lots of choices. The question becomes, one of how do you know that you're big enough, sophisticated enough, that the market will benefit you until you stick your toe in. And then, having stuck your toe in, you say, I'm not any of those things. It didn't work for me. What the bill says is the commission may, but there's no assurance that they will. And with the greatest respect to Ron, I got to tell you that I've argued in front of him something that the commission should or should not do, and been told quite clearly that it's their policy call, and they may or may not do it, and they may or may not appreciate my client's position. FOMA is saying, let's make it open that there is going to be a, using my new term, regulated option for those customers that want to come in and out, if you will, in the market, waiting to see when the market might actually work for them, getting sophistication, watching what the energy suppliers deal with, and that the commission have the ability to do a rulemaking that sets up those kinds of issues in a forum where we can spend a lot more time putting forth real objective evidence about where the market is and what might be the right answers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question. Minus the language in California that doesn't have this language, what is an example of a BOMA member down there, in brief experience, a BOMA member down there having what would be a bad experience with one of the providers?
Well, I've been told by the BOMA organization that it belongs to the umbrella organization, which is national, and that nationally this is recognized as an issue. And so what I've been told is that they're working, for instance, on the federal level for the stuff that Clinton administration is putting out to make sure that this is covered. But what they're seeing is, or what they're seeing the potential for, is a series, for instance, of 8 buildings that are aggregated works fine in the get-go, but then one or more of the owners changes on those buildings, and one or more of the owners say, I'm not interested in paying a power marketer to come in and make sure this works for me. I just want to go back to something that is, as Chairman Hill described, a more contained or knowable or known quantity, and I just want to deal with it that way.
Can you point to an example? And I realize it's a brief experience, but point to an example of here is how, when it plays out, you get the bad actor, bad provider that, and we're damaged by it.
One example, off the top of my head, since I wasn't prepared to answer that question, is a situation where you have buildings in less desirable areas of town, where with a residential customer, the concern was that they'd be redlined and providers would be less interested in serving in those areas. And that same situation exists for commercial properties. The concern being that if a commercial property has an option through only one provider who's interested in serving in that area, that provider isn't going to be competitive because he's got no competition. So his rates, his electric rates, compared to what the right price should be, meaning if the market works in an efficient fashion, is higher. Now the building owner has two options. He can raise the rent, except that's not practical because he's got leases tied in and the market controls rent, or he can reduce his profits. But if he reduces his profits, he's in effect saying to his banker, my building isn't worth as much because I'm not generating the same level of revenue. So either direction devalues the value of the building, devalues the financial benefit of the building, because the market really didn't work. There was only one provider who was willing to serve in an aggregated fashion or a singularly fashion in that area.
Chairman. Representative Witt. Representative King. Thank you. Going back to Section 4, Ms. Fisher and Mr. Gallagher both know that this was a concern that I had in terms of the interpretation. I do have a concern that, you know, it looked to me in first reading of the bill that once you're in the rate, it looks like you're in that rate forever, and that didn't make a lot of sense. And that we do need to have some way of making changes subsequently.
and that was the position, as I understand it, that, that BOMA had. And then I spoke with Mr. Gallagher, and he explained to me that, in, as I understand it, in Section 4 on page 7, that that language, in effect, sets up a circumstance where people are making their choices, perhaps with their aggregator, in terms of what contract they want to have and how they buy the rate, and then they go through their contract, and they, subsequent to that contract, they want to go someplace else, then they can. So that was my understanding. But then, if, you know, as I, you know, worked back on that, it seemed like there were different opinions in terms of what that was, and then, you know, we appreciated the, you know, some interpretation by Mr. Ekus, you know, who has given some interpretation. But I do have to say that, you know, if that is effectively done in Section 4, it, you know, it isn't all that clear, and I would want to be, you know, confident that we do have that provision so that, you know, if someone, you know, does have their contract of choice period done, that they can then go on to another and to have a clear understanding of who it is that's absorbing that risk of subsequent change. And I'm not seeing it really clear in this, and I'm not seeing a result in this debate, but these seem to be the people who resolve that question.
Representative King has struck me in terms of the testimony here. What is the driving factor that what defines what an electric consumer is? So in terms of I buy a house, I turn the person before me turns electricity off, and I turn it on. Is that a, for the purposes of this, is that a new, and you would come in under a cost of service? So if I were someone who were to choose to jump to market, and I decide I don't like this, I turn the electricity off, I call up and say, disconnect me. They come out, disconnect you, and then you reconnect the next day. Hey, turn the electricity back on. You, I mean, how are you going to define this, or is it going to attach to the person? And if they have chosen to go to market, I mean, I'm just, does this solve some of the problems in terms of the transfer of ownership and those types of things? Because that is a new consumer, or is it the actual physical site building which becomes the controlling element?
Mr. Chairman, it is the customer. In the case of residential customer, you don't have a problem here because you're on cost of service rate. You're not in direct access. And in the case of the bill, a small commercial electric customer, we would be providing a cost of service rate option for the small commercial customer, however the commission ends up defining it in rules. So for those customers, they have a cost of service option and they have the portfolio option. And it's pretty much as it is now. Concept of this bill is to move to a competitive market, a direct access market for the non-small commercial customers and the industrial customers. And if you have a situation in which you offer them cost of service in a manner in which it's very easy for them to continue to switch back and forth, you have not only increased the cost of service rate, you have inhibited the market that you were trying to encourage. This bill contemplated that if we found that there were situations in which customers of any particular class that did not have a cost of service rate, a cost of service rate was needed either up front as a transition mechanism or after we find problems exist, it allows us to do that. The balance here is in between trying to create and allow a competitive market and whether or not customers have the options that they need. In the case that you described where you may have a commercial customer and that commercial customer signs what's basically a contract for energy service provision from a competitive provider, and that customer either decides he wants a new provider, depending on the terms of that contract, but he can choose a new provider, assuming there are providers out there. Or if it's a transition, there's no provider out there, they can go to what would be the default rate. And the default rate is probably going to reflect closer to the market than the cost of service rate might. But no customer will be without service. And I think the question you have here before you is to what degree are you going to require a cost of service option be made available to other than the residential and small commercial customers? And how often is your expectation that they could switch? Now, 102 took an approach in which we said, we'll make a cost of service available to everybody, but once you leave it, you don't come back. This bill takes an approach, if you follow through Section 4, on page 8, line 9, it says that we regulate the cost of service rate option, and that on line on 3 sub B, it says we can prohibit or otherwise limit the use of cost of service rate by retail electric customers who have been served through direct access and may limit switching among portfolio options and the cost of service rate by residential electricity consumers. So I guess we've looked at this, felt that the bill really has addressed this. It's allowed the possibility of a cost of service rate for other than residential and small commercial, and it gives us the authority to impose the limits that we think may be necessary on it, and it does provide the default rate. So I think the question being raised by BOMA is really, do you want to have a required cost of service rate for all commercial customers? And in which case, I think you will have a lot of people who have been involved in this bill say they did the bill this way because they didn't want to create a situation in which you were inhibiting the market that you were trying to create by always having a cost of service rate out there. Now, you could do it, and if we still had the ability to prohibit or otherwise limit, we could still try and take the approach. But the approach that I think we would take is reflected in 102 and what we've said before might not satisfy BOMA. Because I think it is a mistake for both purposes of cost of service and the market to provide something in which even with penalties, that you can make more frequent changes. I think the energy service providers will tell you that that will inhibit their desire to actually come out and participate in the direct access market that you're trying to create.
Representative Witt.
Well, let me ask you this question. What if we said in the bill the commission shall develop a cost of service rate for commercial customers who choose to leave direct access, but in that rate, the commission shall include costs, both administrative costs and market costs, or market disruption costs that that decision could cause. Is that feasible?
I won't say it isn't. I think we had anticipated that in part that was the default rate, that was the rate that customers, if their existing provider left them high and dry, or they didn't want any of the markets, that they'd have the default rate to get them by and get them get continuous supply of energy until they could go to the market. If what you're suggesting is that we might have a third rate, instead of just a cost of service and a default rate, we'd have a third rate that is for those people that had direct access and wanted to come back on. I'm not sure that's going to satisfy BOMA because that rate is going to be higher than the cost of service rate.
Representative King?
We could do that.
Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to respond to something Commissioner Aitken said, which is, and he said it several times in his testimony, which is, I don't think this will satisfy BOMA. I don't think this is what they want. I don't think that this is my knowledge. Look at it, and I think that may be projection. The expectation is that there would be a third option that would provide great assurance, that would incorporate the cost attendant to have it. And if 100,000 customers use it, it might have a different cost base than if 100 customers use it. And that the purpose of putting in the language regarding the rulemaking was to have the commission, give the commission flexibility to deal with the situation when we get there, but know out of the box that we have something available that will assure the businesses that we represent have an option out there, and that this bill doesn't present a detriment to us. Now, I think that the comment that this might chill the development of the market is an interesting one, because from my perspective, and outside of coming down and talking to you all, I do negotiate power contracts. What I find is that if your load is large enough, there are energy suppliers who are willing to provide for it. But there are circumstances, either by size or location, where they're not so interested in providing for it, and therefore your options are very narrow. And what we're trying to do here is to make sure, certainly in the transition, if not forever, that that hole in this bill has a way to address the concerns that may arise without constraining the rest of the bill work.
Representative King?
Mr. Chair? I want to break in for a moment, and it has to do with just the microphones, making sure they kind of wander around. There's a good chance that somebody in the future may actually want to review this tape, and we should probably make sure, since y'all are sharing one tape, that y'all are on that. I don't know if Annetta is catching. We're doing okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative King?
One of my original concerns, as I stated, was that I didn't see an apparent ability to make a change subsequent. It was looking like once you're in for lifetime. but I concur with the commissioner that at will changing would raise the cost, you know, to the provider, which then would have to make that higher cost available to everyone else. So I just wanted to have some clarification that the mechanism for allowing subsequent change would be the duration of whatever contract the person picked out of a portfolio of options offered by their provider. And that if that's the case, for example, let's say someone took a 3-year contract in terms of what rate package they want to have at the end of that 3 years, then they decide whether they want to continue with whoever is providing that service, that if then they do make a subsequent change, and if there is a loss, that loss would be taken up by that energy provider, i.e., for example, an aggregator.
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I think we're maybe talking about different kinds of changes here. There's one kind of change, which is changing from one provider to another. And how that's done is sort of be decided by in part by the market itself, the nature of the contracts, what the customer is willing to sign on to, what the offerings themselves are. And, marketers could probably give you a better idea than I can of what those types of offerings and how that might occur. I think the type of change we're talking about here is going from an open market to another type of offering, not a free market, open market offering. And we have thought the bill addresses your issue of can you address that is built into the bill. It may not be satisfactory, but it is built into the bill in that we have the ability to do a cost of service rate for other than residential and small commercial customers if we think it's necessary. And we have the default provider. And that default provider would be there for anyone who either simply wanted to get out of the market or who bought not by their own choice, who the market left them high and dry because PG&E for some reason went out of business and left all these customers, they would have a default provider. Our intention is that we would bid that out. So that would always be there.
Excuse me, the commission would bid that out?
Pardon?
The commission would bid that out?
We would have the utility bid it out.
In their service territory?
Yes.
Okay. You used we, and that's why I was just confused.
I'm being very generic here. We meaning that our provision, we had contemplated that it would be bid out. The PUC had contemplated that.
Okay. Any members?
I think Mr. Gallagher was
okay, briefly.
He was part of my question.
I just want to say, Mr. Chair, that I think quite simply you have three choices here. There should be three choices. There should be those people that go to market. There should be those people that get protected as is outlined in Commissioner Ickes' statement, and those two work just fine. You will develop a market. If you go to some quasi third option, where people exist in the shadow land or moving back and forth between the market and the utility, you will not have a market developed. You might just as well not do the bill, because we're not talking about BOMA members here. We're talking about all commercial customers, and I think that's a point that the other people that aren't up here talking and should be up here talking are all the other commercial customers. This is just one group of commercial customers.
Well, I will just take the liberty, since I'm the chair, and I'll ask a simple question. If you're so fearful of having this default rate that everyone's going to then go into this and therefore destroy the market, then you're telling me that the market isn't there for it in the first place. So in terms of, I mean, I'm assuming that the market will develop because it's a good thing, and you're arguing that if you have some what one could argue is a safety net there that gives some rate stability over a period of time, you're suggesting that that is going to be so disruptive as to disrupt the development of the market on the other side.
Mr. Chair, I agree with half of what you said. The half of what you said is that there should be a default rate there that people could go back to. And I think that's where we keep getting confused here.
Do you agree that it should be stable?
There should be a default rate that people can go back to.
Should it be stable?
It can be as stable as you can make it, depending upon how many customers are in it and what the terms of the contract are.
Yep.
And if you do that, you will have a market. So they're not mutually exclusive, and your statement is accurate the way you said it. There will be a market if you have a default rate.
How about the other half? I'm interested in what you might have disagreed with Tom in terms of that.
Accurate. Wants to disagree with
the other half. I want to.
Good question.
I think the question goes this way. Why wouldn't a market develop? And in the first place, you have a large amount of costs in coming in, establishing a business, going out and look, marketing for customers, and doing the startup piece of the cost. There are a number of markets over the country opening up right now in over 20 separate states. And you're talking about a totally private investment, not cost of service investment that comes to the ratepayer. Somebody has to make a business decision to come in and invest the money. And if there is no reason and no market for them to come to, because people stay in a cost of service rate just like they have right now, there's no reason to make the investment. That's why. It's just a pretty simple economic startup business. Open the market, people will come. Open the market only slightly, a little bit, people make a decision on whether or not to make the investment. Simple.
Thank you. We're going to recess until 4 o'clock. My intention at 4 o'clock is we're going to go over the Dash 22s. So I'm trying to give time for people to read them, come back, and then we're going to take testimony on the 22s, Dash 22s, and what are the Dash 16, Dash 6, and the Dash 16s. Question, Representative Montgomery?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Procedural question. Since we were talking about one of the taxing bill that's going to tax businesses and everybody all throughout the state, this is going to collect an awful lot of money. Procedural, will this be going to Ways and Means? Because the money will be coming to a state agency, which needs to be cleared. Does this bill go to Ways and Means, as I think it should? I don't see it on the list, but at that time, I don't think it had this much money involved in it.
Representative Montgomery, we have only increased the bill by $5 million of the 40-some-odd million that is anticipated in the original bill. It does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. That would be something to discuss with the Speaker.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Montgomery,
in my district, only $5 million is a lot of money. Thank you.
So I just wanted to discuss that we have increased the bill. It came over from the Senate at about $42
million. Representative
Gwynt.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make the point that in your absence, I let the folks from BOMA know that they would have an opportunity to come back with some language.
Yes, and that is my intention. I suggest we start talking together and listening to each other, because I think in terms of everybody saying the same thing, I think, as I heard, BOMA is wanting some assurance, and it may be just simple definitions that was presented, and I suggest let's further talk on that. We will recess until 4 o'clock.